It's a pleasure to see you this evening, and this is the beginning of a three-day series on the evidences for God in the natural world. And I'm thankful for the way you sang that song that we sang tonight with such enthusiasm, because what you were saying out loud was, we believe our God is alive. So the topic tonight, as an introductory lesson, is, can Christianity and science coincide? All of you in this audience most likely are believers in God already. But what I want to talk to you about tonight is the fact that there are many in our age, including many among the college community, who are not believers in God and who are very evangelistic about their non-belief. And so much so that our young people are being faced with great challenges because of this. And I will tell you a little bit of personal background. As a teenager, I too was challenged by the evolutionary theory as it was taught and propounded in the 1960s. My kids say that was before the flood, but I'm not quite that old yet. That was an exciting time in the history of science, and I'll be telling you a little bit about that tonight. But it was also a challenging time, as people were dealing with whether they could believe in God anymore with all the advances being made in science. So I want to talk with you tonight about the question, can Christianity and science coincide? There are lots of folks who would say, especially in the academic community, absolutely not. Richard Dawkins, a professor of public understanding of science at Oxford University, one of the foremost spokesmen in our time for the popularization of science, has become one of its most successful and skillful popularizers in this century. He's also an outspoken opponent of belief in God and certainly of Christianity. He has often spoken and written to convince the public that the natural sciences and the evolutionary theory in particular in biology represent an intellectual highway to atheism, as it did for him personally. So I'm going to give you a couple of quotes from this gentleman, who is a foremost spokesman today for atheism. This quote is from his book called The God Delusion. "If this book works as I intend," he said, "religious readers who open it will be atheists when they put it down. God," he says, "is a delusion, a psychotic, delinquent, invented by mad, deluded people." A second quote from his book, The Selfish Gene, says it this way: "Faith is blind trust in the absence of evidence, and even in the teeth of evidence. It is a process of non-thinking." So that's what he thinks about you folks tonight who just got through singing, "Our God is alive." You do that by faith. That's a process of non-thinking. Many are saying that faith and science cannot exist together, because faith is not based on evidence. Faith is based on blind acceptance. And science is based on evidence, so they say. That is a common expression among many college and university professors. And I can tell you that on our college campuses in our country and around the world, there's deep antagonism to Christianity and the belief held by millions of students and their parents. And on many campuses, a significant number of faculty members are representatives of what has been called the adverse culture or the adversary culture. And their agenda is nothing less than to separate students from their Christian beliefs and their intellectual and moral commitments that they learned from childhood. Don't doubt me about this. I've been around the academic community for a long time. In contrast to that, I want to read you what the Scripture says. In this lecture tonight, we're going to be talking primarily from something other than this book. But since I'm speaking in a church building, I think it's entirely fitting to start with something the Bible says. Psalm 19 says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. There is no speech nor language, their voice is not heard, their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world." The testimony of Psalm 19 is, you can look at nature and hear the testimony of the God who made it. And then, is this thing turned on? There we go. I'm going to quote for you from Romans chapter 1. "For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." The Bible clearly proclaims that you can determine the existence of God by an examination of nature. And so is the case for a number of scientists throughout the ages. And so I would like to refer you to folks back at the beginning of science as we know it in our modern world, and let you listen to some quotes from some of the greatest scientists that have ever lived. Like Johannes Kepler, 1571 to 1630, known for his great studies of the heavenly objects and doing extremely complicated observations and calculations. Here's a quote from Johannes Kepler in the 1570s to 1600s. "I was merely thinking God's thoughts after him. Since we astronomers are the priests of the highest God in regard to the book of nature, it benefits us to be thoughtful, not of the glory of our minds, but above all else of the glory of God. Studies in the world using science are acceptable to me and to Christians, since our faith holds that the world was created by God in weight, measure, and number. That is in accordance with ideas co-eternal with him in his book, The Harmony of the World." Johannes Kepler is given credit for being one of the greatest discoverers of evidence for the God in the natural world using science, beloved. And he openly proclaimed that a study of science brought him closer to a belief in God. And then, probably one you know better, is Isaac Newton, 1642 to 1727, the co-discoverer of the calculus. In case you're not aware, I was a calculus teacher for about 35 years. It's only the most important subject in the sciences, because mathematics is the queen of the sciences. If you can express science mathematically, you've reached the pinnacle of what science can do. And you have just been thinking God's thoughts after him, which is exactly what Johannes Kepler said. Here's a quote from Isaac Newton from the general scholium of his most famous book, Principia. "Though these bodies," speaking of the heavenly objects of our planetary system, "may indeed continue in their orbits by the mere laws of gravity," and you probably know Newton is credited with mathematically describing the law of gravity for the first time in history, "yet they could by no means have at first derived the regular position of the orbits themselves from these laws. Thus, this most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being." And thus Newton declared his deep and abiding faith in the God who made this universe. I'm thankful that Christianity was a founding ground for the modern day science approach. In fact, I'm convinced that it would not have happened had that not been the case. Christianity supports the study of science because it supports an orderly universe created by a grand designer. And in the early 1800s, in fact, this book was published, book called Natural Theology by William Paley, was published first in 1802. And were you a college student in England and lots of other European countries in those early days, you would take this class. It was called Natural Theology. It was a study of the evidence of God by collected from the appearances of nature. And it's full of evidences for the existence of God by examining the natural world. So I'm here to tell you that in the 16 and 1700s, the worldview among the most important scientists in the world was that the most significant thing you learn from science is that there's a God, and that He created, and that it is therefore designed by a master designer whose thoughts were thinking after Him. That's how modern science originated. But I'm sad to tell you that in the centuries after that, what Romans 1:20 and Psalm 19 teach us out of the scriptures became completely twisted and turned around. And so between the 19th and 20th centuries, the worldview that was accepted by the academic community completely changed, ladies and gentlemen. And you are living this side of that. So what I want to do now for the next few minutes is explain to you how it is that the worldview, which in those early days was totally given to there is a God using science, turned the exact opposite. So just a brief history here. Follow me. In the Cosmos series, Carl Sagan in the 1980s said this: the cosmos is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be. I pause. That, ladies and gentlemen, in the 1980s was a statement of the common worldview by that time toward the end of the 20th century. How did we get there from where we were in the 16 and 1700s? Here's how. Folks like Pierre Laplace in France, who looked at the same evidence that Isaac Newton looked at, and declared this: nature with its matter, energy, and forces could produce and maintain our solar system. There's no need for a God hypothesis there. And he rather proudly proposed such a thing in the late 1700s. And it became more and more accepted. You don't need a God to explain how the solar system got here. Nature could do that. Charles Lyell in his Principles of Geology, written in the early 1800s, was an attempt to explain the former changes in the Earth's surface by reference to the causes that are now in operation. He said, the present is the key to the past. All those things you see in geology can be explained by natural causes over long periods of time. You don't need God for that either. So, for example, for you who live in America and have probably once in your life maybe been to the Grand Canyon, the position of Lyell and many others in geology is that formation took place over long, long periods of time by the gradual erosion of water and other things. You don't need any kind of special event caused by God. Charles Darwin in the 1800s published his book in 1859, in which he drew the conclusion there's no need for a designer to account for the origin of species either. Natural selection, acting on natural variation, counts for the appearance of design in living things. That, ladies and gentlemen, over a period of 100 years, became the accepted doctrine of the academic community. Things evolved by natural causes over long periods of time. You don't need God. And so the position is, the more science unveils to us, the less you need God. You had a God of the gaps anyway. You only stuck God in where you couldn't figure out what was going on. And then Alexander O'Perrin and J.B. Haldane from England declared there's no need for God to produce life from non-living matter either. And they proposed a theory for how non-living matter somehow became living. The subject is closed, because from non-life to life, from all kinds of geologic formations, from the universe itself, everywhere we look, you don't need God. Nature explains it. Cosmos said, all there is, all there ever was, and all there ever will be is the natural world. It's eternal and sufficient to account for everything you see. And that, ladies and gentlemen, has become the common worldview in our time. What I want to do with you tonight for the next few minutes is share with you in broad brush some things that have happened in the last 70 years. I've been alive that long. And I have lived through this, and it's an exciting time. And so before I go down this path, I want to say to all these young people here, you're entering into your young life as youngsters and teenagers when the common view in the scientific world is you don't need God. That was unfolding before my eyes when I was your age. And I was scared that if I studied science deeply, that I would lose my faith in God. I want to tell you 70 years later, not quite that long, 50 years later, I'm a stronger believer in God than I have ever been. And the evidence for God that's unfolded before our eyes in the last 70 years is overwhelming. And while you might listen to the new atheists today, like Richard Dawkins and Christian Huygens and others, you would think that the case for God is over. And may I say to you tonight, it's the exact opposite. The case for belief in God from the natural world has never been stronger. So I'm saying to you tonight, I want to revisit the argument from design, which has always been the strongest argument for the existence of God in the natural world. What did Romans 1 say? It said, since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made. The argument is, if you can examine nature and see evidence of design, that is a powerful evidence for the existence of God. In fact, this passage says there's no excuse for missing it. So now, I'm turning from this book, and I want us to take a good look at God's other book. And that's the book of nature that testifies to him. And so we begin tonight. I hope you can come back tomorrow night and Wednesday night to get further of the story. And if you'll invite me back, we'll do six more. Because there's lots of wonderful material to study about design. So here we go. I am referring to this gentleman's books because I think he's one of the best writers of our time. And I'm going to take a little side trip here. I was at Harvard University in 1967-68. I was privileged to go there on scholarship and study science with an emphasis in chemistry and take a number of courses of all kinds. In fact, I took advantage of the situation to take as much as I could because you're sitting at the feet of some of the greatest experts in the world. So I took astronomy under the foremost radio astronomer in the world at that time. I took a course in the history of biology and the history of chemistry and the history of mathematics to look at the broad picture from experts in those disciplines. And I can tell you it was a heady time for science because the general view was, listen, folks, in time you believers in God better get over it because we're going to discover how this world works to such a degree you don't need God anymore. That's what I was facing. And so I spent every spare minute in the libraries at Harvard, and there's 65 of them, and couldn't find anything worth reading from a creationist standpoint. It was quite discouraging. That is not the case in your time. There is a massive amount of excellent material, good science that's well studied and well supported and substantiated that you can find in lots of places. So, Ed, were we able to get the bibliography done? Ed Ledford, were we able to get the bibliography done?
Yes.
It's ready?
Yes.
Okay. When we get finished tonight, I'm going to tell you about a lot of books. You don't have to write it all down. They're in the bibliography. And by the way, the good ones have stars by them. And I will recommend to you that if you're a student and you want to dig in, you get those starred books and you get started. Because we won't touch the hem of the garment, folks. But Stephen Meyer is one of the best. So I have lined up books here, folks. Were we reading these books tonight? No. I'm going to show them to you so you can read them. This is what I call his trilogy. Signature in the Cell, published first in 2009. This is a study of DNA and what it speaks to us about. It's, well, pretty thick and a little heavy in places, but you can skip the hard parts. It is well written and well done to talk to you about how there's a signature in every living cell. I'm going to give you a taste of that tonight. That's your read for tomorrow night. His second major book is called Darwin's Doubt, and it focuses in on what Charles Darwin, one of his biggest doubts. In the fossil record class, it's very clear that at the Cambrian layer, there's a massive explosion of new life forms without anything preceding it. And Darwin's question was, how is that possible? It looks like creation. And it does. So this book explores the origin of life itself. Where did life come from? From non-life. And it's a treatment of the latest information we have about that. And may I say to you that since the 1960s, when I was first studying this myself, until today, the case for the origin of life, for those who believe it somehow originated without God, is worse by far than it was 50 years ago. We know less about how that could possibly start without God than we did then. And this book is full of good information, Darwin's Doubt. And the third book, which just came out last year, Return of the God Hypothesis, is an argument that in the 20th and 21st centuries, the evidence of science has so turned that it's really hard to ignore that science is leading back to saying there had to be God. So this puts the ribbon around the trilogy. And if you want to start at the end, this one. So I'm going to use some references from those texts tonight, and I'm going to start with that one by telling you the three key things that have happened since I was at Harvard as we uncovered the history of the world using science. And what we've learned is, number one, the universe, that is space, matter, and time, had a beginning. I'm pausing. Those of you who haven't been here, when I pause, I want you to think a minute about what I just said. That is very irritating to atheists. In fact, some of them said, we don't accept this, we can't accept this. Their view for a long time was that nature's eternal. It goes on and on and on, there's no beginning. And it is what produced everything you see. If nature had a beginning, how'd that happen? They don't like it. And rightfully so. Because when you go past the beginning, what do you do from there? It's a problem. Now, I'm not dwelling on that one tonight. The name for it has become the Big Bang Theory. That was given to it as a name of derision by the scientists who didn't believe in it. And I'm not saying I agree with everything the Big Bang Theory says. I'm saying what I do agree with is there's scientific evidence there was a beginning. Space, time, and matter. Okay, if there was a beginning to that, then what produced space, time, and matter? Couldn't have been space, time, and matter. Had to be something else. That is overwhelming, class, because nobody would have believed that in 1960. But now the majority of the scientific community does believe that with the problems that go with it. Still not ready to give up atheism, however. A second major class of evidence is that the universe, our solar system, and the Earth are remarkably fine-tuned to support life on Earth. And they have been that way, as far as we can tell, from the beginning. So how'd that happen? How is it that the universe is fine-tuned? I'm going to talk about that one a little tonight. So we'll come back to that. But there's a third great class of evidence since the 1960s that even the simplest forms of life at the biochemical level contain a massive amount of digital information that's being used to produce and maintain an untold number of molecular machines in every living thing. You see what I've underlined? The beginning, the fine-tuning, and the massive amount of information. Look, folks, as far as any scientist knows, information comes from intelligence. Period. There is zero evidence that massive information ever came from anywhere other than intelligence. So all three of these classes of evidence, the subtitle of his book was Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe. It's really, I'll have to say, satisfying to a student who struggled with this and was belittled. At this stage in my life, now to talk to some of these folks and say, well, now what are you going to say? Because this is a challenge. The evidence of science itself has now become so strongly pointing to design and therefore a master designer that is really difficult to explain away. So let's spend a little bit of time tonight talking about these last two. Obviously, you understand we're going to skip the high points and we're going to only hit the high points. From his book, The Goldilocks Enigma, Paul Davies, an atheist, says, one of the most significant facts, arguably the most significant fact about the universe, is that we are part of it. How did we get here, we living things? It is arguably the most significant fact. And then he said, everyone agrees that the universe looks as if it was designed for life here on Earth. This is a man who does not believe in God, but he has to admit that the universe looks like it's fine-tuned to support living things here on Earth. How is that? It's an enigma. If you don't know that word, that's something that's a puzzle. You can't figure it out. And why does he use Goldilocks? You remember Goldilocks' story? I'm going to keep you awake. You remember Goldilocks? He didn't want to say if he did anyway. All of you remember Goldilocks? She went into the woods and what? This is a class so you can talk. She found the house of the three bears, right? And she went inside and she started testing out stuff, right? First thing she found was some bowls of porridge and she ate daddy's porridge and it was too hot, and she ate mama's porridge, and it was too cold, but baby's porridge was just right. That's why he calls it the Goldilocks enigma. Because when you look at nature, folks, everywhere you look, things are just right to support life on Earth. Why is that? Looks like a plan. That's so when I was in school, before the flood, there were two characteristics of the cosmos considered fine-tuned, and some 8 to 10 of the solar system that were in this category being fine-tuned. By the year 2000, folks, there were 38 characteristics of the cosmos and over 150 of the solar system, and it's more than that today, that all look like they're all fine-tuned for the same general purpose. Now, if you were, ladies and gentlemen of a jury, and I was the lawyer trying to, I would say to you, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you could say it's coincidence for 10, but 200? Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, when you reach 150 to 200 different things that all seem fine-tuned for the same thing, you might want to think, somebody designed that or planned that out. And that is precisely where we are today with regard to the fine-tuning of this universe. So my job for the next few minutes is to give you a brief overview of some of this. I just want to give you a taste because I want you to see that it's massive. massive. So here's my next book I want to recommend to you. It's called God's Crime Scene by J. Warner Wallace. J. Warner Wallace grew up an atheist. His daddy is still an atheist. He's doing his best to try to convert his daddy. That's why he wrote this book. And they're policemen. In fact, he became a cold case detective. You know what that is? That's somebody who takes a case that's been dead for a long time and nobody knew how to solve it, and then you bring it up and try to solve it. That's some of the hardest things a policeman ever does. He applies the principles of cold case detective work to the universe, and he calls it God's crime scene. And I love it because it's excellently done. So there's a chapter in here that talks about fine-tuning. And let me just find my page here because I want to read you just a little bit about this from his good work. He talks in here about how you could look at things that are fine-tuned and give you an idea of what that means. And in the chapter, it's called Tampering with the Evidence. That's the title of the chapter. So can I come up here close, and I'm going to read you a little bit out of this chapter. Every chapter starts with a cold case he was trying to solve. Helen knew something was wrong when her daughter Carrie failed to answer the door. It was a bright summer afternoon. Carrie said she'd be home, and her car was indeed parked in the driveway. Helen tried to peek in through the living room windows, but the curtains were drawn. Carrie never locked the back door, but when Helen walked to the backyard of the old home, she found the door locked and all the windows closed. This wasn't like Carrie. She usually left one badly worn rear window slightly ajar. Not this time. Helen began to panic. She knew Todd and Carrie had a tumultuous marriage, one that included physical violence. Todd had moved out, but Helen still feared for her daughter's safety. You see, the couple had a child named Lexi. But the evidence had only intensified the violence since her birth. A week ago, Todd threatened to kill Carrie. And just last night, Carrie confided that there had been another fight. When Helen couldn't get Carrie to answer the door on this afternoon, she decided to call the police. Now, I'm not going to read all the rest of this, but the police came. They got into the house, and it had gas, so they brought on the experts. They eventually found Carrie and Lexi dead on the second floor in their beds. It looked like a clear case of asphyxiation. And so they started to unravel the evidence. Nobody saw what happened. There's no direct evidence. It was a series of circumstantial evidence that added up, and I'll tell you the end of the story. Over time, Todd was convicted of first-degree murder of his wife and daughter with a compilation of the evidence. So he used that as an introduction to talk about the fine-tuning of the universe and some of these features I'm going to tell you about that all have to be just right, or we wouldn't be here. See, in the case of this murder, the question is, how did you get two dead bodies? In the case of our subject tonight is, how did you get all the live bodies? How did they get here? And so the question is, how did that happen? Well, there are lots of things that you can add up. But you see the list up here? Folks, there are laws of nature. There are physical constants and ratios. There are properties of elements and chemicals that all are fine-tuned. I wish this were my chemistry class a week for the next 6 days could talk about this, because it's incredible. I'm going to tell you one. So here we go. Imagine in covering the entire North American continent in dimes, stacked until they reach the moon. You with me? Picture in your mind, dimes stacked all over this continent until they go to the moon. Now imagine stacking as many dimes again on another 1 billion continents of the same size as North America. So you have 1 billion in one continent stacked with dimes to the moon. You got it? Your mind clear? If you marked one of those dimes and hid it in the billions of piles you'd assembled, the odds of a blindfolding friend picking out the correct dime is approximately 1 in 10 to the 37th. That's 10 with 37 zeros. Okay, you with me? That's how close the strong nuclear force has to be with what it is, or you wouldn't be here. And let me say that again, because I lost you. If you change the strong nuclear force, which is one of those physical constants that we've learned about the universe, if you changed it one piece in 10 to the 37th, you wouldn't be here. That's one of them, ladies and gentlemen of the jury. I can list you a whole bunch of others. I already told you, 38 characteristics of the cosmos and 150 of our solar system. That's one. Wish I had time to talk about more. We're in a galaxy. Does anybody know what our galaxy is called? We call it the Milky Way because when you look across our sky, it looks like it's a Milky Way. And that's a bunch of stars and galaxies that you see. And so it's called the Milky Way. Class, there are lots of galaxies. You're not denying that, are you? Lots of galaxies. In fact, I thought I'd show you a very recent picture of a part of the galaxy. So before I show it, look at my arm here. If you took a grain of sand and held it out here at arm's length, the amount of sky that that grain of sand would cover is about what's covered in this picture. What I'm going to show you is a picture taken by the James Webb telescope that was just sent up of deep space. And so the picture really only covers really one little teensy piece of the entire universe that we've never seen before. So here it is. Can we turn off lights for just a second? And are these up here on a different switch? I just want you to pretend like you're out in the Midwest in a desert. Oh, that's good. Close that door back there. Come on, somebody close the door. Oh, no. Did you cut off the projector by switching that light up? This is not good. All right, well, cut it back on, please. I'm so sorry. You didn't tell me that. Can you recover it? Oh, please. But I wanted you to feel like you were out in the desert, people. You did for about a half a second. All right, while we're waiting, when that comes back, the reason I want it to be really dark is because I want you to examine this little teensy piece of the universe and look at what you can see in it in the telescope's picture. This is an infrared telescope that's picking up signals, and they did it over 12 and a half hours. So it's stuff that's never been seen. All right, how are we doing? I'll tell you what, I really blew it that time. Yeah, that, you can't blame him for that. All right, is it coming back? Oh, good. All right, while we're doing that, let me read you one more. Imagine comparing the universe to an aircraft like the USC John C. Stennis. It's 1,092 feet long and displaces 100 of water. If this carrier were as fine-tuned as the mass density of the universe, a billionth of a trillionth of the mass of an electron from the total mass of the aircraft would sink the ship. I lost you. What he's saying is you've took a little piece out of that whole aircraft thing, or that ship, it would sink. So if you change the mass density of the universe by that much, we wouldn't be here. That's number two, class. Is the mass density of the universe important? It's critical to your existence. And there are lots of these. All right, here it is back. I won't ask them to turn it off again. Do you see these things right here? These, you say, isn't that a beautiful star? No, class, that's a galaxy with billions of stars in it. You with me? And you see that one right there? Can you tell from where you're sitting that that's got spirals? That's a spiral galaxy. And you can see it in this picture as one of a whole bunch. But I challenge you, can you find another one? Well, it's kind of hard. Which leads me to my next point. The galaxy matters, class. You can't just have any old galaxy and have life like we have it. This is the galaxy cluster SMAX 0723, taken by the James Webb Space Telescope, July the 12th, 2022. Incredible. And it's all over this universe. But class, may I say to you, it is without question that we've discovered out of all of this that the proper type of galaxy to support a living planetary system like we have has to be a spiral galaxy. And only 10% of all the galaxies in the universe that we know anything about are spiral galaxies. The rest of them are elliptical and irregulars, and some of them are ciphers that blow up every so often. Not good for supporting living things. So what I'm telling you, class, out of that picture I showed you a while ago, 99% of those are out as a source for living things. Now, you can call in another lawyer and let him argue the case, but I'm telling you the truth, and you don't have to believe me. Go to the books. I'm telling you the truth. So it needs to be a spiral galaxy like ours. We just happen to be in the right kind of galaxy. Isn't that interesting? And therefore, they're living things. It's a coinkadinky. But it's not good enough just to be in the right kind of galaxy, class. If you were in the center of the spiral galaxy, let me show you a sideways picture. A spiral galaxy has a big old blob in the middle. If our sun was sitting right there, you wouldn't be here. The gravitational and magnetic forces in the centerpiece of the spiral galaxy are so massive, it would be, you wouldn't be here. In fact, for any spiral galaxy, it's well established that if you're going to have a living solar system like we have, it has to be in one of those two areas, which is less than 1/150 of the total volume of that whole galaxy. Folks, that eliminates almost every bit of the spiral galaxies as a place for living things. Are you with me? Jury, I can't lose you now. And that's a fact. But it has to be the right kind of star, even if you're within that right kind of place. You can't just have any old star. Guess what? We have the perfect star. Or as nearly perfect as you can get. So here's our sun in a mock-up compared to our planets. There's the sun, Jupiter, and Saturn, and then the smaller ones. And the sun looks pretty big there, doesn't it? But if you compare the sun to Sirius, the dog star, and Pollux and Arcturus, there's our sun. It's really kind of small. But I'm not finished. Watch this. Everybody, eyes up here. What if you compare our sun to Betelgeuse and Antares? Where is the sun? It's right in there somewhere. It's the size of one pixel. There are stars massively bigger than our sun. Do you think, class, that Antares could have a planetary system around it? If you do, you're not thinking. It's so massive, any planet, we go crashing into it in microseconds. No. You got to have about an average-sized star. There's a lot of stars smaller than our sun. They're called dwarf stars. There's a lot of dwarf stars, too. Guess where our sun is? It's smack dab in the middle. But it's not enough just to be the right size class. It's got to be the right temperature. And it can't be blowing up all the time. It's got to have features in addition. And I don't have time to talk about all that, but it's the truth. And then you have to locate the planet in the right place, right? So here we go. Here are our planets, Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus and Neptune and Earth. And what's that one? The next closest one in size. No, that's Venus. And this one is Mars. And this one is, say it, class, the smallest one closest to the sun, Mercury. And this one is Pluto, that got written off as not a planet, but it's back. Yes. And listen, if I had time tonight, I would take you on a space trip to Pluto. Did you know the New Horizons space program went all the way to Pluto and took close-up pictures? So it's back. It's a frozen planet, but it's back. So out of the nine planets, class, how many of them are in the habitable zone around our sun? You know it can't exist anywhere else. Well, there are three. Earth, Venus, and Mars are in the habitable zone. Venus, folks, has an atmosphere of sulfuric acid. Not too good for living things. It also has a problem with temperature. It gets up to 900 degrees Fahrenheit sometimes. Venus is out. Do you hear NASA talking about looking for life on Venus in your newspapers? No, where are they looking for it? Mars, because it's the closest possibility. And because they think they found some possibility there might be some water that might have been there sometime. Our Earth is covered with 70% water, which is another one of the big deals. So the planet has to be in the habitable zone for the star. It can't be just any old planet. And do you think Jupiter, folks, could support life? Folks, Jupiter is only good, well, I'm sure it's good for a lot of things, but it diverts comets and asteroids and other things that could hit us because it's so big. And by the way, on that trip to Pluto, they went around Jupiter in a whiplash and whoosh, threw one out to Pluto and went a lot faster because of the gravity of Jupiter that helped them. Fascinating. But see, all of those things are not enough. In addition, you got to have the right mass for this planet. It's got to spin at the right rate. It's got to have the right tilt. It's got to have the perfect moon. Did you know we're one of the few objects anywhere that has just one moon? And it's big. And it's beautiful. It's not just for you to sit around mooning with your girlfriend. It does all kinds of things that supports life. And if it weren't just like it is, just right, you wouldn't be here. So there's a whole bunch of more things here we could talk about every one of these. Properties of biochemicals like DNA and proteins, don't get me started. And then cells that contain the genetic code in their DNA and the molecular machines, which is where I want to go next. You got to hang out with me for just a little while longer. Every one of these deserves six lectures. But ladies and gentlemen of the jury, every one of them is fine-tuned within a very narrow limit, so you wouldn't be here. So let's talk for just a minute about this incredible thing. The smallest functional living thing is a cell. And when Darwin was alive, they used to say it was a little albuminous glump of carbon. They just thought it was a blob. Folks, not only is it not a blob, everything that happens in New York, London, the six biggest cities in the United States and in the world is not equivalent to what goes on in that one cell. And there are all kinds of things going on in here that require machines that work better than the machines we build. And they do it by themselves, automatically, beyond belief. Don't you miss tomorrow night. I want to show you just a little bit about scale. Here's a meter right here in the middle. A megameter is a million meters, but I'm going small now. So a decimeter is a tenth, a centimeter is a hundredth, a millimeter is 1/1,000th, a micrometer is 1/1,000,000th, a nanometer is 1/1,000,000,000th, and a picometer is 1/1,000,000,000,000th of a meter. A meter is about this long. Think in your mind that you're dividing it up into a billion equal pieces. 1 billion. Whew. Is that tiny? That's the scale we're talking about right now. So I want to show you some things that are down on that scale. Here you go. Here's a frog egg. You can see a frog egg with a magnifying glass. It's about 1 millimeter in size. But now if you want to see a paramecium, that's about 100 micrometers. You got to have help, so you got to have an optical microscope. If you want to see a biological cell, you certainly need electron microscopy. You can't see them with your eyes. So I got to get this clear to you. One cell in my body, of which there are trillions, I can't take one cell out and look at it. It's too small. It's teensy. It's on the scale of 10 to 100 micrometers. That's 10 to 100 1/1,000,000th of a meter. And then we go smaller than that because bacteria are down to 1 to 3 micrometers. Antibodies are 10 nanometers. DNA is about 2 nanometers. And atoms are down in the range of 0.1 nanometers. And there's your water at 0.28 nanometers. If you had talked to Darwin about nanometers, he would have rolled his eyes. And we are nanometer-sized things right now and trying to mimic what nature does. So the next little bit of my lecture is fun. Okay? We're going to have fun. A molecular machine is a natural device on the molecular scale, that is on the nanometer scale, able to convert chemical energy to produce linear or rotary motion as well as controlling many biological functions. It's a little tiny motor that can take energy, chemical energy, and convert it into motion or doing something. And folks, your cells has 1,000 of those things running around in them every second. Why do you think you get tired sitting there while I'm talking to you? Your cells are busy. There are thousands of these little machines doing stuff that are unbelievable. Every one of them deserves much more credit than I'm going to give them. So one example is myosin. It's for the contraction of your muscles. Another is kinesin. It helps move stuff around. You know, when you're building stuff, you got to move stuff around, don't you? You have warehouses. You got to go from here to there. Well, so does your cell. If something's being made over here in the cell and it's got to get over here, something's got to move it. Well, one of the great movers is kinesin, which has only been discovered in the last 20 years. So, can I not mess you up this time and have you do a perfect job? I want to show you a kinesin machine. This is called a kinesin walker. And before you start it, hang on just a second. You see that big glob right there? That's the thing it's having to carry. And right here is the machine, and this is the highway inside your cell. Look, class, what's this? This is happening inside your body right now as I speak, in one of those cells. There's building going on, construction, and destruction, by the way, all the time. So kinesins are busy while you're sitting there loafing. They're moving stuff. So let's show them a picture. This is a cartoon, you understand? But it represents life. Okay, the thing it's carrying, stop right there. The thing it's carrying is called the vesicle. It can be whatever needs to be carried. And this guy can carry lots of different things, about 20,000 times as big as he is. He is a wrestler for sure. By the way, can I take another little side trip? When we lived in Romania, my wife and I went up to the northern part of the mountains during the winter, which was crazy, and they wanted to take us to the castle of Vlad, Count Vlad. Y'all know this guy? Yeah, not a nice guy. And while we were traveling through that mountainous, icy, there was no things on the side of the road, and the road was flat. That guy was driving like Jehu, like a madman. And off the side of that thing, like this, and down, 1,000 feet down. And the only thing that stopped us was a tree with a bank of snow on it. And we climbed out the top window and got out of there. And here we are sitting on the side of the road, knowing we had just escaped death. Now what? What do you do? You're in the middle of nowhere. Our kids would never have found us. A truck came by, a van, with 8 wrestlers. I'm not kidding. They were Romanian wrestlers that had just won a match. And they stopped, and those 8 guys pulled that car up. I'm giving you that example to tell you, this guy is better than they are. He carries massive things all over yourself. So here we go. This is now what happened. Oh, I hit the forward button. I'm supposed to be letting him. You're calling me an F tonight. Can you get back? Good night. How many things can I do wrong? While we're waiting, a kinesin is just one type of moving things. You may not have noticed, but there's one called dynein. Did you know that in your lung you've got millions of little cilia that do this to help you exchange the oxygen? Little cilia. They're kind of silly, but they're very important. And they help you exchange oxygen. Did you know you have to build those cilia? And kinesin helps carry the stuff out to the end of that cilia, and dynein helps carry it back. That's one of the things that happens. Are we back? Okay, good. All right, now I'm leaving it alone. You go ahead. All right, now you watch the motor, I think. Is that next? Yeah. Here's the motor. See, isn't he walking beautifully there? Stop right there. Class. I'm telling you, if I had the time, I could tell you the chemical reactions that are taking place that allow him to step. It's specific chemical reactions that take place that allow him to do this and move. So it takes chemical energy. And I can tell you exactly where that comes from. ATP and ADP in your living system. But it's all used in an amazing way. Efficient. As he moves this stuff. Now, it doesn't really look like that, you understand? But it's a chemical machine making this thing move. And now let's go to the next thing. Go ahead. Because see, the other thing that's important here is he can't just walk anywhere in the cell. He's got to walk along a highway. See that thing there? Now, that thing he's walking on is called a microtubule. It is built by the cell by itself. You have thousands of microtubules all over your body, inside your cells. If all of them remained, you would die. So your body eats them up periodically and gets rid of them, and then builds new ones at an immense rate of time so the kinesin can walk on it and other things. Are you getting a little bit of a picture, class? None of this was known 50 years ago. So dynein and motile cilia, I've already talked about a little bit, and the ribosome. Tomorrow night, we're going to do ribosomes and we're going to do flagella. You don't want to miss this because it's going to build on what I told you tonight. So what I want to do tonight, that's the kinesin walker. I want to go now, we've already seen that one. I want to go now to this gentleman, Dr. James Tour. Do you see his credentials up top? He's a professor of chemistry, materials science, and nanoengineering at Rice University. Folks, there are nanoengineers all over this country and all over the world. working at the nano level. I told you, that's 1/1,000,000th of a meter. And they're doing stuff at that level so they can try to imitate what nature does with machines. So this man is one of the foremost experts. He's a messianic Jewish man, and he's a firm believer in Jesus Christ as the Son of God, and of course in God. And he would say to you when he does a lecture, as he did at Dallas in the Discovery Institute lectureship there on the origin of life, he would say to you, folks, when people sit around talking about how life originated from non-life, they need to deal with reality. It is ridiculous what they're talking about. It's a bunch of hooey. I said that, not him. So he decided, why don't we just build little cars? Maybe that's the best thing we can do first, to get a molecular machine. So they have built cars out of molecules. In fact, the goal is to build a car out of one giant molecule and make it race. Well, all of you know enough about cars to know you got to have fuel, you got to have wheels, you got to have a suspension system, you got to have sensors or actuators, you got to have all that stuff if you're going to run a car. So that's what they've done. There's a picture of a nano car built by Dr. What was his name? I just forgot. Dr. Tour. I'm old, so it's okay. You see the wheels, suspension system? There's a whole bunch of stuff tied up in there, but it's all at the molecular nanometer level. And there's a picture of one. Of course, it's not anywhere near that big. You can't see the thing. You have to look at it through an electron microscope, and you use the computer to even see it. Okay? And it runs well on gold, a gold surface. So what these guys do is primarily use gold and silver as their surface. And they're literally now have run some races. So I'm just going to briefly tell you that the teams on April 28th and 29th in 2017 in Toulouse, France, interestingly, that's the place I used Sunday morning where they had the conference. You remember that they declared having a Bible in your language is heresy? Was it Toulouse, France? Now they're racing nano cars at Toulouse, France. So here the Austrian team with Rice University combined, you had France, Germany, Japan, Switzerland, the U.S. from Ohio University, each had their own nano car, entered into a race for the first time in history. Nano cars. It's not exciting to watch. It's like watching a cross-country race. Not even as good as that, because you can't see anything. But they did it. And I'm proud to tell you that the Austria-U.S. Rice University team won the whole thing by going 150 nanometers in 1.5 hours on silver. Switzerland came in second by going 133 nanometers in 6.5 hours on gold. That's the next closest thing they could do. And France, Germany, Japan, and the other U.S. just kind of backed out. That doesn't mean much except this class. A human built a nano machine that they raced. That's amazing. But here I'm getting to a point. You listen to me closely. The first generation that he built, they spent 20 years building that thing. The first one he built would only rotate 1.8 revolutions per hour at 60 degrees centigrade. See that little rotor right there? It would only rotate 1.8 times every hour. I mean, that's slow. The second generation, and look what they did. Here's the first one. Here's the second one. You see that S right there? That S is missing over here. You have a 6-ring chain here. Here you have a 5-ring chain. With that one change and all the other things built around it, it increased the speed to 3 million rotations per second, which was why they won the race. And you say, so what? Here's what. Dr. Tour said, the nano cars built by our team were much smaller and far less complex than the Kinesin walkers that I just showed you that are common in every living cell. The Rice team's been working on nanocars for over 20 years. Every molecular machine in living cells is much larger, more complex, and much more sophisticated than anything we built. Here's a taste of how much work and intelligence it took to produce that nanocar. You watch my machine here. That is a description of the details of one molecule characterization, page one. This is page two. You want to read that? That's what it took them to build one little tiny machine over a period of 20 years with a whole lot of intelligence. And after he got through winning the race, the other people said, well, aren't you going to write this up so we can imitate what you did? He said, absolutely. And so, does it show the date up there? Right there. May the 17th, 2017. 1 month after that race, which he won, he wrote this article in Tetrahedron magazine. And look what it says. The synthesis of light-driven motorized nanocars for linear trajectories. So he wrote an article explaining all of this, which included those two pages I just showed you. And can you see how long this article was? 281 pages of that stuff. It's what it took, class, for intelligence to produce one nanocar that could get about 150 nanometers in an hour and a half. The Kinesian and Walker would slaughter him. Walking. And there are hundreds and hundreds of them doing better than that every second. Well, there he is. Little guy rotating his wheels, moving at almost no speed. That's really amazing speed for nanometers. So I end by saying to you, if you were in a jury and you heard this case, could you, in all the honesty of your heart, leave this kind of circumstance and say, isn't it amazing what nature did by itself? No guidance. There's no engineering here. No design. It looks like it's designed, but no. Nature did this. Natural selection, acting upon natural variation over millions of years, produced this. You can say that? And I would say to you, as a lawyer, I'd say, I feel sorry for you. Because he's guilty of sin. And there's way more evidence for this than there was for his guilt. Don't leave here saying there's no God. Anthony Flew said there was no God for years. He was one of the foremost atheists of our time. He was a philosophy teacher, an atheist, and a debater. He debated lots of Christians and thought they were foolish for believing in God. When he turned 80 years old, he wrote a book called There Is No, I Mean A God, How the World's Most Notorious Atheist Changed His Mind. I love it when an 80-year-old man can change his mind about something as significant as this. And he did. And he's openly saying, he wrote a book about it. You ought to get the book. It's on my list. And here's what he said in an interview with several believers like Gary Habermas and Craig Hazen. He said, it has become inordinately difficult even to begin to think about constructing a naturalistic theory of the evolution of that first reproducing organism. Would you agree, class? The enormous complexity by which the results were achieved looks to me like the work of intelligence. It now seems to me that the findings of more than 50 years of DNA research have provided materials for a new and enormously powerful argument to design. And he said, I give up. There has to be a God who did this. Now, we shouldn't believe because Anthony Flew changed his mind. But I'm asking you, Look at the evidence. This man said all his life, I will follow where the evidence leads. And he literally did it. He changed from black to white. So is it reasonable to believe in God in this scientific age? Can Christianity and science coincide? Class, it has never coincided better in the history of mankind. The evidence is overwhelming. Now, does that mean there aren't any issues? Of course there are issues. But the evidence is overwhelming. Everywhere we look, from the macroscopic to the microscopic, things look like they are made, or as Michael Behe says in his wonderful book, Darwin's Black Box, which, by the way, has a more recent edition updated, and he says the case is even worse for evolutionists. There's a loud, clear, piercing cry of design. And by the way, he capitalizes it. Exclamation parts in the book, so it's okay for me to scream. Yes, class, it's more reasonable than ever to believe that there's a God. Now, I get feisty in lectures like this, and I make no apology, because if you read Richard Dawkins in his spewing ugliness books, he gets very feisty, too, to trying to tell you how stupid you are for believing in God. And listen, class, don't you believe me. There's lots of stuff you can study about God's nature. You go look for yourself. For me in my house, I am overwhelmed with the evidence that there's a masterful, phenomenal, grand designer who is so far beyond anything we can imagine that all we can do at best is try to pitifully imitate in some tiny way what he's already done. Yes, it's reasonable to believe in God. In fact, it's unreasonable not to. I hope you become a believer if you're not. And if you do become a believer in God, then may I suggest to you the next thing you need to do is look up John 14, which says, in the words of Jesus, if you believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you, and if I go, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. And he was asked, how do we know the way? He said, haven't you seen me? You've seen the Father if you've seen me. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. Why could Jesus the Christ say that? Because he is the only one who was man and God who gave his life for you and for me. And because of that, we have hope. So you need to learn who Jesus is if you've become a believer in God. I don't know where Anthony Flew is on that one. He became a deist. That's a God who doesn't get involved directly. I hope he'll change that mind also. And you too. So we're going to close this service with a song. If you're here and you'd like to confess the name of Jesus and say, I believe he's the way, the truth, and the life, we'll stop everything and immerse you in water for the remission of your sins, and you can begin your life for him. Come while we stand and as we sing.
Bidding us look to realms above, while the light from the throne shines for you and me. Let's listen.